This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Among the key findings of the study is that children in local areas hosting the refugees are also facing high levels of deprivation.
That's Catherine Nambi reporting from Kampala on how children in a host country are affected by large numbers of refugee flows. Details coming up.
Also, attacks by groups in Mozambique's gas-rich reserves in the north could threaten the country's $30 billion investment. And aerial search teams have found the wreckage, but no survivors, from a small plane that crashed north of Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: reports indicate that a certain group beheaded 10 villagers in Mozambique's gas-rich north late last month. Beyond the loss of life, this is a concern for the Mozambique government because the attacks could threaten the country's $30 billion investment in the surrounding area. To shed light on the matter, we have in studio Amancio Miguel from the VOA Portuguese service.
Thank you very much.
First thing, identify for us who these people are responsible for the attacks. Are they like terrorists or common bandits?
Well, there have been so many reports on that. And initially, the government said they were like common bandits. And then locals say they're Al-Shabaab. But we have to make clear here, when they say Al-Shabaab, they don't really mention the Al-Shabaab known in Somalia, for example.
Yes.
It's because they compare the atrocities they do with those of Al-Shabaab. So they call this group Al-Shabaab. And then there have been also studies by Mozambican scholars, and then they concluded that these people might be linked to some other terrorist groups, but they're not necessarily Al-Shabaab. The government now call them like a common bandit.
Common bandit. But Al-Shabaab, the main Al-Shabaab from Somalia, hasn't taken credit for whatever these people are doing.
So far, they have not. These attacks, they started in October last year, and so far, Al-Shabaab never said a single word claiming any of the attacks.
So what kind of damage have they done so far?
Just to give you an example, like this week, between yesterday and today, at least 10 people were killed in two different districts. Yesterday was in Makumia, and today it was in Kirimba, another district in Cabo Delgado province, which is in northern Mozambique. Since this started, at least 100 people have been killed by this unknown group. Although the police in Mozambique, they say they have identified like six people linked to this group. But so far, they have not stop them, although they keep promising that they will stop this acts within a week, but so far nothing has happened.
So you're saying the government has not taken concrete steps so far?
That's one of the major criticisms. The government keeps promising people that the attacks will stop, but in the ground, people are suffering. As we speak now, we have reports that people are moving for their residential areas, seeking refugee in some areas where they consider as safe for them.
These people, these groups that are roaming around, beheading people, killing people, they are actually moving around the big reserve projects of the, if I'm not mistaken, the Ruvuma Basin of the north coast of Mozambique. Could you tell us a little about that area and what kind of a reserve is there?
It's an area which is very rich in LNG, natural gas. At the moment, many companies are there starting. They have done the prospection, and now they're starting to explore. As from 2022, they'll start producing gas. One of the company is American company Anadarko. It's an area which is very rich in terms of natural gas. Actually, they say it's got like reserves that can be enough to supply for 20 years countries like France, Germany, Italy, and Great Britain. So it's a very rich area. But so far, this group has never attacked any of the facilities of the gas companies.
I'm Amancio Miguel from VOA Portuguese Service. Thank you for your input.
Thank you very much.
The mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, has put forward new proposals for dealing with the migrant situation in the capital. As many as 400 new migrants arrive in the French capital each week. In just the past few weeks, authorities have cleared more than 2,000 migrants from Africa and South Asia from camps that had sprouted up in the city. Some of Hidalgo's ideas, however, counter the national government's policy on caring for migrants while their asylum requests are being processed. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris has been covering the story and spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson about the issues.
The mayor of Paris feels that the French government needs to actually take a stand and protect these migrants who are in Paris and who have put forward an application either to be recognized for asylum or refugee status. The mayor of Paris says, first of all, while their papers are being checked, none of them should be sent back to Italy. Now, we do know that at least two-thirds of those who are being housed in this emergency accommodation have already filed an application for either asylum or refugee status elsewhere in Europe, and many of those in Italy. Under EU rules, these migrants should be sent back to Italy. The mayor of Paris says, no, stop that. The situation towards migrants, the environment towards migrants in Italy is now quite precarious, and sending these migrants back will just aggravate that situation. The other point that the mayor of Paris has said is that migrants will naturally come to Paris. I mean, yes, at the moment there are some 400 to 450 arriving each week. She says the city of Paris needs to get funding from the central government to set up another big reception area. Now, in return, the state government has said no, there are 9 small reception areas in the Paris area, 4 of them actually in the center of Paris, that these migrants have to go there.
What is the reasoning behind the desire for the smaller reception areas?
The capital city sort of makes sure that anyone who's arrived in the capital goes to these small centers, and they're seen quite quickly. Within 4 or 5 days, all the officials who are at these small centers look at the papers and then send these migrants to other reception areas elsewhere in the country. That way, Paris does not become overloaded. We don't see the situation where you have these huge camps. On top of that, the French have a system whereby if you have been seen by the bureaucrats, if you've had your papers accepted, and you are then rehoused elsewhere in the country, if you leave that reception center, then you forego any other rights at all. It is really a way that by having all these migrants there in small camps, they can deal with them more quickly, and also they can explain to them, look, you're being moved out of Paris because we don't want you all here, and that we've made a commitment to you. We will look after you. It might take a while, but you've got to stay in our system.
And in Paris, the mayor, though, is saying, go ahead and let them stay in one big center.
That's what she would like them to see. Stay in one big center. Don't split them up. Her point of view is, look, a lot of these migrants are going to come back to Paris anyway. You're just wasting the state's money by sending them off, and sometimes to places really in the French countryside where they just don't have any sort of support structures. So, of course, the state says, if you bring them all to Paris, you're also going to have in Paris the people who work alongside these migrants, some of them illegally, like the people traffickers, like the smugglers, the people who will say to these migrants, hey, I can get you across to England where you can work, and that will cost you 1,500 euros. These are the people they're trying to sort of keep away from the migrants, and they feel that by splitting them up across the country, it's not only making the whole country responsible for these migrants, but it also means that the people smugglers won't be able to get to them so easily.
That was Catherine Field in Paris talking with our colleague, Kate Pound Dawson.
A new international study is urging the Uganda and the international community to help strengthen the delivery of social services to refugee and host communities. A report says tens of thousands of refugee children and children in host communities need assistance. VOA's Catherine Nambi files this report from Kampala.
The increasing number of refugees is said to be fueling the failure of basic service delivery for water, sanitation, health and shelter to both refugees and the host communities in Uganda. This is according to a report by Economic Policy Research Center, the University of Cardiff, and UNICEF. The study, aimed at assessing child poverty and lack of access to water and other social services delivery among refugees and host communities in the districts of Arua, Yumbe, Adjumani, Kamwenge, Isingiro, and Kampala. Majority of the refugees in these districts are from South Sudan, DRC, and Burundi. Among the key findings of the study is that children in local areas hosting the refugees are also facing high levels of deprivation. Access to water has been shown to be the greatest problem, with most households having to walk long distances or waiting for hours in queues for water. Sheila Ann DePio is a research analyst with Economic Policy Research Center. She says although access to services tends to be similar for refugees and host communities, over time, there tends to be less deprivation among refugees. In contrast, conditions for host communities stagnate.
Refugees are becoming less deprived and catching up with hosts. Let me give an example. 40% of hosts are deprived of water. When refugees have just come, about 72% of them are deprived of water. After 2 years, that percentage drops to about 60. When they stay here 5 years, the deprivation for water for refugees drops to almost the same level as the hosts. So we see that the life of a refugee is improving in terms of the basic deprivations, but the one of the host is already not good.
Currently, 70% of financial support goes to integrating the refugees, while only 30% goes to host communities. However, DePio says the approach needs to be revisited as it has widened the deprivation gap between refugees and their hosts.
It is okay that development partners are investing in refugee management. Uganda has provided the policy space and a good environment for refugees to stay. But as refugees' lives are improving, hosts are trapped at very low standards of living. So if we invest in ensuring that the hosts have good lives, access to services, access to basic necessities, as refugees come and we try to build their lives and they converge where the hosts are, then that is a better position to integrate.
Rita Nakafero is a senior community development officer with Water Mission Uganda. She says authorities need to go beyond emergency responses and instead seek sustainable solutions, especially for refugees who have stayed in the country for more than a year.
But we find that the services that come to the people that have just come also end up being consumed by people that have stayed for some time. I think we need to create some levels of self-reliance. Refugees that have stayed for some time should also try to rebuild their capacity to live by themselves, such that the program support always goes to those people that really need to be supported to also adjust and be able to survive.
Uganda is home to an estimated over 1,400,000 refugees from South Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Burundi, Somalia, Sudan, Rwanda, and Eritrea. Uganda has been praised for its generous support to refugees, including providing them with land on which to build shelter. But observers warn that public support for the policy may wane if Ugandan citizens and local communities feel that the government is giving more support to refugees than to themselves. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Our aerial search teams have found the wreckage of a small plane that crashed on a densely forested cliff north of Nairobi with 10 people on board. Kenyan officials say troops specializing in mountain rescues reached the site about 3,600 meters above sea level today, but they found no survivors among the 8 passengers and 2 pilots. The single turboprop plane was on a scheduled flight to Nairobi from the western town of Kitale Tuesday afternoon. It lost contact with Nairobi ground control and dropped off radar screens minutes before it was to land. Officials say a long, difficult climb in bad weather, including dense fog, awaits civilian and military workers seeking to recover the bodies.
Differences between the Nigeria police force and the president of the Senate have erupted into a full controversy, with the police asking Bukola Saraki to respond to allegations he was involved in bank robberies in which more than 30 people died. Reporter Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria, has more on the story.
The police allege Senator Bukola Saraki sponsored the robberies of banks in Ofa in the central state of Kwara in April. Police have said he has ties to several of the suspects in the robberies and they have implicated Saraki. The Senate president says the allegations are unfounded and baseless. Other politicians are expressing anger at the police over the case. Senator Samuel Anyanwu is among them.
It is too appalling and too cheap to drag the president of the Nigerian Senate into a local robbery in his own state, where he has superintended as a governor for 8 years. So it sounds so ridiculous. It's one of the joke of the year. In the eyes of the international community, it is an affront to democracy to drag the number three citizen of this country into such a shame.
Anyanwu says the Inspector General of Police has not handled the matter well. He says there must be a synergy between the Parliament and the Nigeria Police Force so they can work together. However, a retired Assistant Inspector General of Police, Charles Ugomo, says the police should investigate cases without considering who might be involved.
The police have the right to carry out their investigation within the confines of the law as enshrined by the Constitution. In doing that, the person of Senate President should be respected. The Senate President should have some level of immunity. His case should be like any other citizen, judging that he's the number three citizen of this nation.
Political analyst Paddy Njoku thinks it would have been better had the police fully investigated before going public with allegations against Saraki and creating a political opera.
I am not exculpating anybody, but I think that the process leaves a lot to be desired. So I think it would have been more decent if proper investigations were made, proper statements were collected, and probably arrests were made where necessary before you start agitating the entire polity that your Senate president is aiding and abetting armed robbery, because that's what it comes to in the final analysis.
The Senate president on Monday used his social media platforms to announce that he had received a letter from the Nigerian police force asking him to make his defense in writing within 48 hours. Earlier, police said he had been asked to report for questioning. Saraki's 3-year tenure as Senate president has been marred by numerous accusations of misconduct and investigations. Though none have led to criminal charges, those allegations have created considerable tension between him and the police. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja.
Human Rights Watch says the Zimbabwe government's failure to carry out legal and electoral reforms threatens the credibility of the country's general election next month. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Human Rights Watch Southern Africa Director Dewa Mavinga says Zimbabwe risks having another sham election unless President Emmerson Mnangagwa fulfills his promises and implements genuine electoral reforms before the July 30th general election.
In Zimbabwe, there is lack of reforms that risks credible elections. We call on President Mnangagwa to act on his pledge for free and fair elections. We ask President Mnangagwa to go beyond mere rhetoric and take genuine steps to level the playing field for all candidates and their parties.
Speaking Thursday in Harare, Mavinga called for institutional bias to be eliminated.
A key step would be whether state media gives equal coverage and access to all political parties without bias or favor. Zimbabwe's military and other state security forces have for many years interfered with the nation's political and electoral affairs, adversely affecting the right of Zimbabweans to vote for candidates of their choice.
Human Rights Watch says its research in May found security forces involved in the electoral process, abusive laws that remain in effect, and violence and intimidation by the ruling party all contribute to an environment that is not conducive to free and fair election. HRW said it discovered that at least 15% of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's leadership is serving or former military officials. Mnangagwa faces Nelson Chamisa of the country's main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, among several other opponents. The July 3rd election will be the first in Zimbabwe's 38 years of independence without Robert Mugabe, who resigned last November after giving in to military-led pressure. Mnangagwa has lifted a ban on Western election observers, but the opposition says that is not good enough. This week, opposition parties protested the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's refusal to release the voters' roll and said Mnangagwa must have the roll audited if Zimbabwe is to have a credible election. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Burundi's President Pierre Nkurunziza shocked the country today by announcing he won't seek re-election when his term ends in 2020. The announcement to his supporters follows a May 17th referendum on a constitutional amendment that lengthens the presidential term from 5 years to 7. Critics allege it was designed to let the 54-year-old Nkurunziza stay in office until 2034. He took power in 2005 following a bloody civil war. The referendum passed overwhelmingly. However, opponents claimed the government harassed and intimidated those inclined to vote no and that the balloting was marred by fraud. The government denies the allegations. Violence broke out after Nkurunziza decided in 2015 to pursue a third term. The president also quashed a coup attempt. Nkurunziza said today that the constitution wasn't modified to favor him, and he vowed to support the next president with all his heart, mind, and strength. Opponents welcomed the announcement, but questioned whether he's just trying to soothe public unease and might change his mind once the volatile situation cools off. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.